A children's hospital in Kyiv, damaged in a missile attack.
It's literally a disaster, what I'm seeing at this point, because it's a huge territory of the hospital, and a couple of buildings are almost completely destroyed, most of them by the explosion wave, one by the explosion itself, because it was a direct hit.
Plus, ceasefire talks looked promising, until they didn't.
Last night, Prime Minister Netanyahu introduced four new conditions, the first of which is that Hamas actually agree that Israel can continue the fighting.
And later, an election surprise in France, Viktor Orban in Beijing, and record-setting heat. Today is Monday, July 8th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Russia launched a massive missile attack across Ukraine on Monday, killing at least 31 and injuring scores more. In Kyiv, the main children's hospital was badly damaged, and Mayor Vitaly Klitschko said the attack on the capital was one of the heaviest since the start of Russia's invasion in February of 2022. And it's in Kyiv that VOA's Lori London found our correspondent, Anna Chernikova.
It's literally a disaster, what I'm seeing at this point, because it's a huge territory of the hospital, and a couple of buildings are almost completely destroyed, most of them by the explosion wave, one by the explosion itself, because it was a direct hit in one of the departments, the toxicology department, where also children under dialysis are located, and thousands of children at the moment of the attack were inside. Just a couple of minutes ago, rescue workers screamed out that doctors and children were found under the rubble. We don't know yet, it's not yet confirmed if they are alive or not, but I'm just afraid to say, but it looks like it will be really difficult to find anyone alive under that rubble, because the scene is just really scary. We know that a lot of children were evacuated to various different hospitals around Kyiv, because this hospital is the leading children's hospital in whole of Ukraine, and also is very famous in Europe, because it has a lot of different departments specialized on children's care, and this includes also the children with cancer. So intensive therapy of those are also happening here. And at this moment, it's really difficult to imagine where these children will be allocated and how we'll be able to undergo the treatment after this attack, because again, as I said, this is a pretty much specialized hospital, and this means that a lot of important equipment also located there and was destroyed. So this is what I'm seeing at the moment, and also what's probably important to say that thousands, a lot of citizens of Kyiv came here to help rescue workers to save people from under the rubble and to clean up, and I can see so many people were just dressed as they were just walking on the street, like wearing dresses or wearing t-shirts without any special equipment. They are just helping rescue workers, and hundreds of rescue workers are at the scene, and it looks like this operation will be taking probably a couple of days.
Are they still searching for survivors, and how much do they think there are a number of people still potentially under the rubble?
No information on how many people might be still under the rubble, because a lot of people were evacuated, and when the list of those evacuated will be confirmed, then the authorities will be able to say how many potentially people might still remain under the rubble.
And this was unusual because it was also in broad daylight. Where were you when this happened?
Actually, this happened at around 10:30 a.m. local time, and I was on my way out from my apartment building when air raid alarm started, and then in around 20 minutes, I've heard really powerful explosions. Because not only hospital was under attack, some residential areas as well, and business centers and just territory around Kyiv, at least seven explosions were reported. And one of the explosions happened just just next to my building. I was seeing the blast from my window, basically, and I was seeing the point where either heat or debris fall happened because it was a smoke from there. So according, again, to official reports, also another hospital, a maternity hospital, was damaged, not that as badly as this children's hospital, and also some residential areas. I think that what I've seen from my window was a residential area, because this is the neighborhood that was reported as a residential area attack.
Anna Chernikova reporting to us from the main children's hospital in Kyiv. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lori.
Lori London hosts Flashpoint Ukraine Mondays here on VOA. She was speaking with Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. In a related story, China's foreign ministry said on Monday that President Xi Jinping had appreciated the efforts by Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban to mediate a political solution to the ongoing Ukraine crisis. The comments came after the two leaders met in Beijing on Orban's unexpected visit, just days after his talks with Russia's Vladimir Putin angered some European Union leaders. Lin Jian is China's foreign ministry spokesperson. He said that President Xi and Prime Minister Orban talked about bilateral relations as well as the war in Ukraine. Hungary just assumed the EU's rotating presidency this month. Orban has already met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in Kyiv and just recently visited Putin in Moscow. That was a trip that drew strong rebuke from his allies. The Orban-Xi meeting is seen by some observers as a strengthening of the pro-Russia alliance. And as the pro-Russia alliance might indeed be strengthening, the NATO alliance is preparing for its annual summit, set to begin Tuesday here in Washington. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg met with reporters on Sunday. VOA's Misha Komodowski asked him about Orban's visit to Moscow and if his alliance with Putin might imperil NATO aid for Ukraine.
So first, I went to Budapest a couple of weeks ago where I met with Prime Minister Orban, and we found a way to ensure that Hungary will not block the decisions we are planning to make this week on increased support for Ukraine. So that was a good outcome of the meeting.
So you got a verbal yes from Prime Minister Orban?
Yes, so he stated that next to me at the press conference in Budapest. And we also seen it in the preparations for the summit. In short, the agreement Prime Minister Orban and I reached it in Budapest is that Hungary will not be part of the new NATO security assistance and training command for Ukraine. They will not be part of the long-term financial pledge. Hungary will not block other allies from making these decisions. And Hungary will, of course, continue to live up to all their NATO obligations, and they will continue to pay their share of NATO's common funded budget.
In addition to the usual military, financial, and political talk that surrounds a NATO summit, this year the meeting is particularly interesting to observers, but for an unpublished reason. All eyes will be on U.S. President Joe Biden to get a sense of his strength, stamina, and leadership abilities following a poor debate performance and calls for him to drop out of the presidential race. This is of special interest to NATO leaders because Donald Trump, Biden's opponent, has made numerous anti-NATO statements during his first term and has said he would allow Russia to do, quote, whatever the hell they want to NATO members who have not fully paid their share. Meanwhile, in Israel, a ceasefire seemed close at hand this past weekend when Hamas relented in one of its demands, only to see Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu make more. I'm joined by VOA's Linda Gradstein for more.
Well, Hamas has apparently softened one of its key demands, which was that Israel agree to ending the war before the negotiations even begin. In other words, that Israel say that this is the end of the war and then a three-stage process would start. Now Hamas is not saying that. And there was kind of a lot of optimism until yesterday that this was going to be the beginning of something really different. However, last night, Prime Minister Netanyahu introduced four new conditions, the first of which is that Hamas actually agree that Israel can continue the fighting. Now, I find it hard to understand how Hamas is going to actually say, oh, it's fine with us for Israel to continue the war. And after Hamas softened its original demand for an end to the war, they were looking for ways to kind of fudge it. They said that the ceasefire will continue while negotiations continue, and they were looking for ways to kind of fudge this. And now Netanyahu seems to be making it much harder, if not impossible, to kind of fudge this. And there's been a lot of criticism coming, of course, from the hostage families, but also from some in the Israeli security establishment who say that Netanyahu is trying to sabotage the talks, because if the talks do go ahead and there is an agreement and there is a ceasefire, then the most likely outcome is new elections in Israel that he would lose. So you're hearing a lot of criticism in Israel, not only from hostage families, which you would have expected, but even from the security establishment. And that's something new.
So in our previous conversations, you've told me how Netanyahu has been generally unpopular, and it looked like he would lose an election were there to be one. This criticism from the security establishment, though, for calling into question his judgment, though, you're saying this is new and this is important.
Yeah, it's important because basically if, you know, there's been criticism from the army, criticism from the security establishment, you know, and these are people who are supposed to be carrying out Netanyahu's policies. So if they're saying that his judgment is being questionable and that he's perhaps making decisions that are based on his decisions to stay in power, that's pretty extreme. And it seems that, you know, again, no one ever knows and what's going to happen, but it seems that if and when there is an election, that Netanyahu will not be the Israeli prime minister. Most people in Israel, according to the polls, blame him for what happened on October 7th. So it's hard for me to see how Netanyahu could win an election. However, he says that this, the only reason that Hamas softened its demand is because Israel has stayed tough and has been putting pressure on Hamas. Another sort of scenario is that Israel very much wants to assassinate the top Hamas leaders, which it's been unable to do so far, and that Netanyahu is kind of trying to buy time and to continue Israel's efforts to find these people. The head of the CIA, Bill Burns, who has been very active in these negotiations, is coming again to the region this week. Israel sent a delegation. Cairo and Qatar have been very active in this. There's definitely movement. The question is whether these new Israeli demands are going to torpedo these talks before they even get off the ground.
We're going to leave it there for today. VOA's Linda Gradstein. And Linda, thanks for your reporting today.
Sure. Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. This past June was the hottest month of June ever. We'll hear from a climate scientist in a few minutes. Now, though, to France. The French hard right-wing party of Marine Le Pen was handed a surprise defeat in Sunday's second round of voting, with a coalition of left-leaning and centrist parties taking the overall victory. For more, I spoke with Lisa Bryant in Paris. So last week, it looked like Marine Le Pen's far right was headed for victory, headed to power. What happened?
Yeah, it was a huge turnaround. Basically, it was a few things. First of them is that the far left, or the left coalition, they just sort of cobbled together from the far left to the center left, sort of a new movement to try to counter the far right. And that seems to have worked. And so that meant that voters had, like, instead of a number of different options, they had one leftist coalition. The second thing is that all the quote-unquote mainstream parties decided they were going to block the far right from winning. And so therefore, those parties or those candidates that didn't have a chance of winning basically just stepped out. And so that gave the rest of the parties a better chance.
So those parties backed out of the election so they wouldn't split the vote among the left-leaning constituencies, right?
Correct. And even some maybe not so left-leaning voters, because, you know, for example, in the town that I covered during the vote, there were just two options. And one of them was a far-right national rally. This is for the runoff or the far left. And it was a far left candidate. So voters who may not have been particularly far left-ish voted for that candidate because that was all they had.
Well, in certain political circles, there is a lot of talk among right-wing candidates about elections being stolen. Lisa, what's the right wing saying? What's Marine Le Pen's reaction to this been?
It's been real anger, and it's a feeling that that this victory that seems so close, I mean, which it would have been an historic victory, was just basically quote unquote stolen from them. But it's good to sort of step back and see what they actually did gain, which was quite impressive. They gained more than 50 seats. This is never, you know, this is really unprecedented. And, you know, if the next few years don't turn out too well for this coalition, if it ever does come to power, this left coalition or with Macron centrists, you know, they could be positioned for in a really good way for the presidential elections, which are just 3 years from now.
So it looks like the French government will be led by a majority kind of center-left coalition with a fairly large far-right-wing minority. What can we expect going forward from the French government? How well can those groups function together? What's going to get done?
That is the major question right now. And some people are predicting just total gridlock over the next few years, because as you noted, there is a sizable far left or leftist coalition. There's the centrist, which is another sizable bloc, and then the far right. And so it's possible nothing could happen and there'll be a lot of bickering and just nothing going forward. The other option that at least one analyst told me about was that, you know, it's possible that Macron will try to weave a sort of coalition with the left and try to govern in that way.
VOA's Lisa Bryant is in Paris. Lisa, thanks for your reporting today.
My pleasure.
Recent elections in Iran as well. President-elect Masoud Pezeshkian spoke to a crowd of supporters.
I consider your vote as a heavy responsibility on my shoulder, and I pledge to continue to be a listening ear for your words and a voice for the voiceless and rejected.
Pezeshkian was the sole moderate in the original field of four candidates in an election seen by the West as neither free nor fair. He replaces hardline president Ibrahim Raisi, who was killed in a helicopter crash in May. And now on to the Pacific, where Japan and the Philippines have signed what they're calling a reciprocal access agreement, allowing them to deploy their forces on each other's soil. It's a milestone in their security relations amid rising tensions in the Indo-Pacific. The two countries signed the agreement saying they were seeking stability in the region amid rising tensions with China. You've heard us reporting on it, and you can probably feel it where you live. It's hot, hotter than normal, for longer than normal. Kylie Vaughn reports on the record-breaking heat.
This past June marks the hottest June ever on record, according to the EU's Climate Change Observer on Monday. Experts warn this could put 2024 on track for being the world's hottest year recorded ever. This is the 12th straight month that the world is breaking record warm temperatures, according to the EU Copernicus Climate Change Service. The latest data suggests 2024 will overtake 2023's record after human-caused climate change and the El Niño natural weather phenomenon both pushed temperatures to record highs in the year so far. Climate scientist Frederica Otto says the results don't come as a shock. She explained these past 12 record hot months are due to our high record of greenhouse gas emissions from burning fossil fuels, which she says will result in dire consequences.
The human rights of a vast majority of the people living on this planet are massively violated because these hot months mean hotter heat waves. It means much more heavy rainfall events with devastating floods as a consequence, which do violate the right to life, the right to housing, the right to a free culture and social life for many, many people. And that is why we care about climate change.
The impact of climate change has already been devastating this year, with over 1,000 deaths during the Hajj pilgrimage last month and other heat deaths reported in places like New Delhi and amongst Greek tourists. Despite the cyclical nature of the El Niño phenomenon, which adds to rising global temperatures, the solution to rapidly rising temperatures is reducing greenhouse gas emissions from activities like burning fossil fuels. Despite promises to curb global warming, countries have so far failed collectively to reduce these emissions, pushing temperatures steadily higher for decades. Kylie Vaughn, VOA News.
And speaking of the climate, dangers to journalists covering the environment are rising. Reporters are paying a heavy price to get their story, including violent attacks, detainment or arrests, and sometimes even death. In Africa, the coverage of illegal poaching, mining, and pollution increases risk of attack or threat. VOA's Robin Guess reports on what reporters face.
Ghana's Joy News covers illegal gold mining destroying the country's forest.
Abandoned pits and mining settlements dot the road leading into the remaining part of the forest.
When journalist Erastu Sasari Dankor went to investigate, armed men in uniform confronted him and his crew.
They wrestled with my camera technician for the camera and broke it in the process. They made him delete every footage we had on the camera. They smashed our windscreen, punched my driver several times in the face. And it was horrible.
Ghana's 2022 Journalist of the Year, Asari Dankor, documents the environmental cost of illegal gold mining. His stories expose the connections of illegal mining to the spread of disease, deforestation, and widespread pollution in rivers and streams. The International Federation of Journalists finds reporting on poaching, illegal mining, and illegal logging is hazardous across Africa, but legal mining is also problematic.
Journalists who report on the activities of these big corporations are seriously threatened. They are seriously threatened, and they are not actually allowed to report on such activities, especially when it concerns environmental degradation.
Tomasi says environmental journalists face attacks, detention, and arrests. And in Africa, he adds, dangers exist in every nation with valuable and exploitable resources.
They are subjected to serious threats, which actually force them to abandon the line of thought or the reports that they are engaging.
In its May report, Press and Planet in Danger, UNESCO finds 749 journalists and media outlets attacked globally from 2009 to 2023, and 44 reporters slain for their environmental coverage.
It shows it's a planetary problem. Journalists who are trying to uncover corruption or whatever related to environmental issues, they are being attacked everywhere.
According to UNESCO, attacks against environmental reporters are rising sharply.
The number of attacks, different sorts of attacks, they are concentrated or they are higher in the last 5 years. So it's not only that it's a lot, but it's showing that there is unfortunately a trend of a growing number of attacks or violations.
For journalists on the ground, the risks are ever present.
And so constantly I face danger. I face a lot of danger during my work. Armed people, people who wouldn't want the truth to come out. And so I must say that every trip is a risk.
Asari Dankor says he's only armed with a camera, a drone, and his crew, but adds he cannot let the violence stop him from revealing the environmental damage being done. Robin Guess, VOA News.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.